everybody, this is the Marcus Today on the Couch podcast, and today I have the pleasure once again of speaking to John Abernathy, the chairman of Clime Investment Group. John is a very well-known economist, value investor. He's had 40 years of funds management experience in Australia. He's a director of WAM Research, Wilson Asset Management Research LIC, and was well known in the broking circles as the general manager of investments of the NRMA in his day. John now works at Clime, and every 6 months or so, he puts his economic views and equity market views down in a letter to investors. Today we are talking about his November letter to investors, which is available on the Marcus Today website. Welcome, John, to the couch. And before we get into the discussion of the November letter to investors, can I just take you back to the June letter to investors? John, you had a fairly optimistic analogy about coming through the clouds. Australia had a bright future and that we weren't going to see a deep recession. That's all worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it has. Well, we haven't got a recession, so that's pretty well sums it up. It's low growth, Marcus. I mean, in my mind, surprisingly low growth, but explainable by the fact that we really haven't got proactive policies in this country. I think one of my arguments is lack of coordination between fiscal management and monetary policy, and I think it plays out every day when you watch what's going on. And we'll get a reading on this, Marcus, in the next few weeks when we get the mid-year budget update, which will obviously show a substantial surplus. And it makes you wonder why more hasn't been done to fight inflation through fiscal policy, which would take the pressure off the central bank in terms of managing interest rates. But I guess we'll get to that.
One of your clear messages is that fiscal policy has to kick in and that the RBA can't do it alone. Because we've got, of course, very different groups in the Australian economy. We've got groups of retirees would be too much of a generalization, but people who are not leveraged into the property market, who are doing well out of higher interest rates, and those who are leveraged and are struggling. And there is still going to be an ingrained inflation push from those who are not leveraged. Are the hairdressers and dentists to blame, John, do you think?
No, I think what is lost in a lot of media commentary is that the cost of doing business as opposed to the cost of living has gone up. And why I say that, you know, the everyday costs of running a business and producing goods and services, the fundamental costs are the cost of energy, cost of rent, the cost of money, and the cost of wages. They're the things which drive up the cost of doing business. And if they're all heading in one direction, good businesses will, and particularly strong businesses, will put up their prices to recoup their margins and to maintain profitability. So it's a loop which occurs. And why I'm critical of government, I think a few of the cost factors which are affecting the cost of doing business and therefore inflation could have been checked by more significant government initiatives, you know, in terms of tax cuts for low income earners to stop the wages push, you know, an edict not to put up the cost of electricity and admittedly maybe through government support across the economy. It's good stuff that they've done some relief of energy prices for low income earners, but it doesn't help the big energy users who are supplying products and services. You know, if their bills are going up, the prices of food and services are going to go up with it. So there's so much more the government could have done. And when we see this surplus appear in a few weeks' time, I think it'll become obvious to everyone that there's much more should have been done to fight inflation.
And the outlook for interest rates then over the next year or so, how soon do you think Australian rates are going to get cut, or are we going to see a two-year holding period whilst our own demand-driven inflation persists?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty adamant, Marcus, that there's two things we've got to think about. Interest rates in America are too high for where they are in the cycle. They should not be 5.5% with inflation readings in the low to middle threes. Having said that, Australian interest rates are too low, given our inflation reading is in the fives. So the fact that Australian interest rates are about 1.25% below American cash rates is unexplainable by inflation, but only explainable about the amount of leverage in the household sector. So our interest rate policies are not set by inflation. They're set by urgency of the issues addressed, which are facing households. So what I think is going to play out, I think American interest rates were not going to go up any higher. they'll probably see good reason to cut them in the next 6 months, not by much, but bring them back towards 5%, which is still elevated given if inflation sits around 3%. And inflation's coming down quickly, Marcus. I mean, if you look at energy prices around the world, particularly petrol prices and gasoline prices in America, there's been a substantial drop. I expect similar inflation issues to appear in Australia. I think by the middle of next year, we'll have, it looks like we'll have much lower petrol prices, much lower energy prices, and that'll feed through in the cost of doing business, and we'll start seeing inflation come down quite quickly and surprise markets. And that'll be a relief to the central bank because they don't want to put up interest rates and they'll be praying for inflation to come below their interest rate settings. And I think they'll get that gift, and it'll start appearing by March next year. And that leads me to think that interest rates may have 0.25% more increase next year. Then they'll sit there for at least 6 months to a year. And that'll be the appropriate rate of interest so long as Australia's inflation is sitting in that 3 to 3.5% band, which I think it'll sit for most of next year. So that's a fairly benign outlook. Interest rates go positive against inflation. Bond yield sitting around 4%, not really challenging the equity market. PEs slightly expanding, Australia benefiting from the tailwinds of population growth, hopefully a bit more sensible government, particularly into an election. We can't forget there's an election coming up again in 12 to 18 months. And you can guarantee the government will start spreading the joy through budgets. That surplus will be wilted away through largesse. And then you'll get a very strong Australian economy 25 financial year.
And you've talked about Australia's economic outlook in your last letter to investors being far superior to our peers. And yeah, I assume you believe that will unfold.
Well, I think it's exciting. I mean, I guess we are getting older, Marcus, and I'm becoming quite losing patience with politicians who don't have a vision. But Australia's outlook is so outstanding compared to the Western world. Who would want to live in Europe or Japan or North America at present? The outlook for Australia with 26 million people growing rapidly, probably immigrating too many, to be frank. But with our trade surplus, our current account surplus, our excess savings for superannuation, our budget surplus. I mean, if you looked at us from afar and said, what's wrong with us? I think you'd be struggling to find out what the problem is. We seem to read too much of the newspapers. We listen to too many hedge funds, too many foreign commentators about Australia are talking their own book. And we don't have strong leadership in this country to really drive the opportunity, which we clearly have. But I think it'll come through. It's a bit like America, Marcus. The American economy does very well no matter who runs the country. In fact, the corporate sector and the entrepreneurs of America grow their economy. I think that'll be a factor which drives Australia. The politicians will talk twaddle, and the business will get on with it and grow and meet the challenge of increasing demand coming out of Australia and also coming out of Asia.
John, let me just unpack a little bit of that. In your last letter, you were particularly, you had a few comments about the pernicious influencers and the media and the tentacles of media who are rapacious in their need to be filled with baseless and misleading content. Have you had a particular experience with the media, or is there a particular media outlet that is irritating you, John?
I don't want to go into great detail. A specific instance was the ANZ case run by the ACCC and ASIC. And if you read some of the judges' comments, particularly in the ASIC review, I know ASIC got up on that one and ANZ didn't keep the market informed. But if you read the factual judgment made, there was a lot of activity by hedge funds in the ANZ placement, which became problematic. And it's quite clear that the power of hedge funds to back out of deals, which they agreed to do, shows you the power of hedge funds. And I think that power of hedge funds permeates through the financial press. I am on the record as saying that it was extraordinary. It's just one case, but I think it's an example of what goes on. The poor reflection of factual information in the market, the keeping away of factual information, and the creation of false information is rampant. I get to the point now, I'm not interested in people's opinions in the press. There's too much opinions and not enough factual reporting. I think the opinions should be left to independent people like you, Marcus, who, you don't have any bent. You just say what you think based on your experience. And there's too little of experience in financial press. They listen to too much nonsense coming out of think tanks, which are running hedge funds or investment banks, and they don't challenge it. And I put in my letter, and I've done the last two letters, you know, the outlook for Australia is extraordinary. You know, anyone who wants to argue against that, I think, is talking nonsense. Now, I'm not saying it's all clear air, but I think this constant talking down the Australian economy is really done by people who want to short the share market one day and then want to buy it back the next. And you can see the volatility appearing even as we speak, Marcus. The week we're in of this first week in December, we've had the market go up 1%, down 1%, and up 1%. I mean, it's just, what for? I do have a theory about that, which we can talk about, but I think there's way too much commentary driving volatility for levered hedge funds and really day traders, and it's not based on logic or sensible investing. And I think what you and I got to do is just talk sensible investing and get people focused on the longer term, because the long term is undeniably good for investing in Australia.
I remember, John, I'll just tell you the story. I used to write the Financial Times market report back in the 80s when I was just a kid. And it was a job writing up the stock market that nobody wanted to do because it was so mundane and boring. And it was always handed to the most junior person that was prepared to put in a small effort for profile. And it still staggers me to this day that everyone from the most professional fund manager to a private investor sitting in their own study is reading the same market report every day. And that market report put out by probably the most junior journalist at Reuters is driving all of our thoughts from the first moment of the day.
Yeah. Well, you'll appreciate this comment, Marcus. I mean, the abuse of the word investor by news agencies, and they say, oh, investors today sold the market, investors today bought the market, investors today were worried, investments today were keen. I mean, they're not investors, they're traders. And I just think we need to understand that market movements day to day are not driven by investors. Investors are generally buyers, buyers for 5 and 10 year views. Traders will trade every minute of every day, just trying to make a small margin with leverage.
Yes.
And I think that the press should say, well, traders today were buying back what they sold yesterday or selling today what they bought yesterday and losing money. That would be more sensible than some of the nonsense talked about and what investors are doing.
Yes, we've at the moment, whoever is writing the Reuters report is obsessed with the adjective surged. And we have banned surge in the Marcus Today newsletter because overstating the Dow Jones surge 0.1%. Anyway, let's get back to the matter in hand. So with the interest rate outlook being quite benign, with the Australian economy looking okay, interest rates, if they're not going to come down, what's going to happen to asset allocations for professional fund managers? Where would your asset allocations be for the year ahead?
The bond market, which is the risk-free market, has obviously moved this year, and they were very low yields coming out of COVID, post-COVID, and we've seen the Australian 10-year bond go from sub 1% to 5%, and now it's back to around 4.4%, with inflation 5.9%. So immediately you see a problem there, that current readings of inflation are well above the current yield on a 10-year bond, which says to me, don't buy a 10-year bond. However, when you look at the 3-year, 2 and 3 years, you've probably got, you know, 4.5% to 5% type returns. Are they adequate? They're okay if you're a very old investor. But against that, there's been very good yields appear in what I call quality corporate debt. And you're getting 3-year yields of, you know, between 6.5% and 7.5%. So if you look at yield against inflation and yield against bond yields, there's been, I think, an over creation of yield in that part of the market. I think that's, if I can see it, I think that's going to be observable to large asset managers. And I think there's going to be a massive demand move to try and pick up that paper in the next 6 months. And direct investors, if they can access that paper through their fund managers or through managed funds, which they've identified, I think the corporate debt market is going to be quite a nice returner for the next 6 or so months. So you're going to get a good yield. You're going to get capital gain as those yields are bid down, so that the piece of papers which are being bought will revalue. So I think that's going to be a quite a nice short-term place to be. When that plays out, and it will play out, then you're back to traditional investing across different asset classes. And quite frankly, with bond yields around 4%, whether inflation is 3.5 or 4.5 doesn't really matter. Those bond yields, to me, drive equity returns, because they don't threaten the equity market. I always talk about my rule of 20, which is the bond yield plus the PE. So if bond yields are sitting around 4%, the Australian share market can trade around 16, give or take. And that's pretty much where it is today. So I don't see the share market having anything other than momentum caused by earnings growth coming out of population growth and demand and Asian recovery growth, strong growth coming out of India and solid growth out of China and related countries. So in terms of your comment, short term, there's yield at play. Grab it if you can see it in high quality yield, but then maintain your diversity across equities, Australia, international. Is perplexing because I think the Australian dollar is oversold, and I think we'll see a recovery in the Australian dollar, which will take some of the tarnish off international returns. But, you know, in a long game, we can wear that for a year. The Australian share market, that yield is attractive. Franking is still there. And the one part of the market which is being battered down is the emerging and small company indices. And I probably do see quite a strong recovery coming in, out of that part of the market next year or so. So if the equity market goes up 1%, for every 1%, I can see the small caps going up 2%. And there's been, you would record times when that happens, Marcus, and it's usually after times when they underperform greatly, they start outperforming greatly. So I'd be attracted to bringing in small companies into my portfolio.
And when you say that, John, a lot of our members would be thinking, oh, I'll buy some small companies, but you're thinking more in the sense of some of the professional fund managers running smaller companies' funds.
Yeah. I think you've got to take a portfolio approach. And look, there'll be a whole lot of different issues which will drive small companies. Obviously, we know the resources sector, there'll be activity there. But getting away from that, the industrials, you know, there'll be those small retailers who'll pick up with the growth in retail demand. The building cycle's obviously going to be strong, so companies feeding into that. Anything consumer orientated, so you can go into automobile companies. Then there's small telcos, and the small IT companies. Anything which feeds off an economy which is solidly growing in 225. But I always say, and you know this, Marcus, the market doesn't wait till it's obvious. The market jumps ahead. So I do think there'll be quite significant recovery in small companies across the economy. So long as they're profitable, I don't think your listeners need to trade unprofitable companies and concepts. I think there's probably dozens of small companies which meet the bill who are good earners and probably being sold down in the market unnecessarily. So, but that's what happens when interest rates go up quickly. Small companies underperform, but when interest rates stabilize and then start firming, small companies come back into play. So I think that's the outlook there for the next 12 or so months.
And we've got quite a well-developed listed auto sector. Probably travel as well might be a thought.
Yeah. And travel's already revalued to an extent. There's a bit of share market performance there.
Okay. A couple of quick views on sectors. Big tech in the US.
Yeah, look, if I'm right, and you know, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but if I'm right, I think the US dollar's probably peaked. So given those big tech companies are multinational, so they trade in US dollars, they've had a tremendous headwind in terms of profitability with a strong US dollar. If that US dollar starts pulling back with interest rates in 2024, that'll magnify earnings, international earnings of American companies, so to speak. So just watch out for that. That's because they've been battling that for quite a while as the US dollar's revalued. I do see okay growth in Europe, nothing dramatic. Asian growth will be strong. Emerging market growth, particularly India, so those international companies, multinational companies who we all talk about, if they're accessing the middle classes of Asia, particularly India and China, they will benefit from that. The American economy may slow somewhat after a very strong 2023, but I think the American consumer is okay. So the question is not so much, are earnings going to go up? I think they will grow for those companies. What is the multiple? The multiple pressure has gone away with bond yields rallying. So if there was pressure, and there was extreme pressure on those markets as 10-year bonds shot towards 5%, there was a real concern about the PEs of those major NASDAQ companies. They are still elevated. I don't see, great value there. But unless you're going into the consumer companies like your Apples and Microsofts, and small business companies like that, suppliers, I think they've got an unfair advantage, I think, in the world coming up. So I'd stick to them, but it'd probably be a bit more selective where I was buying.
Resources, John?
Looks good. I mean, it's being hit with everything. Resources have had a downturn after COVID, rocky growth in China, which is the big resource demander for Australia. I think China has gone through the worst in terms of its property market. I mean, I've looked at some charts recently, which look terrible, and I think people got to reflect when charts look terrible, reflecting growth and starts, price movements, completions of housing. They're so bad at present, they can only go one way. And I think the recovery of the Chinese property market is going to occur. And that really drives up demand for resources. The strong growth in India is still there. So that's going to put demand pressure on international markets across metals and major commodities. So I think the outlook's good. The only thing that will check earnings will be a stronger Australian dollar. So I see commodity prices staying where they are pretty much, but with a stronger Aussie dollar. But the international investor of commodity stocks, think about it this way, Marcus, if international investors are being underweighting Australia because of the weak Aussie dollar, if that Aussie dollar starts showing some strength, you watch the money coming to Australia and they'll buy quality resource companies as a way of playing Australia.
That, of course, was the resources boom back in 2000, 2005, wasn't it? Overseas international investors could not only buy BHP for the growth in China, but they also got a double kicker or double bubble, as everyone calls it, with the Aussie dollar rising at the same time. So you could see the asset allocation meeting was going, we need to buy Aussie dollars and we need to buy resources stocks and BHP and Rio. And it was just an obvious and trade for them.
So let's put another little quandary into the equation for the Aussie. We have a burgeoning superannuation industry, about $3.5 trillion, and we've got industry funds north of $1 trillion. The amount of money going into super is excessive. I've said this in the past, but what that leads to is default investing. And default investing from an Australian perspective is putting 70 cents in every dollar. And every time money goes offshore to invest in offshore markets, there is a constant selling of the Aussie dollar. And I think listeners to this podcast should understand the unrelenting selling of the Australian dollar by our superannuation industry, which is investing offshore. And recently we saw one of the major industry funds set up an office in London to put more money into Europe. Now, I don't know what's so attractive about Europe, but that's what you do when you've got too much money to invest. The Australian stock market is valued at about, what, $2 trillion, give or take. Aussie, the Australian economy is about $2.3 trillion and growing. And industry funds now, I think if you go back maybe 15 years, industry funds might have been 20-25% of the market index in terms of their size against the Australian share market and the economy. Now they're moving towards 40-50% of Australia's GDP and Australia's stock market. It's becoming a big problem. They can't invest in this country. They've got too much money to invest. And that's interesting. So we really have to see a surge in money coming back into the country from foreign investors or Australian industry funds saying we need to de-weight international because the Australian dollar is going to go up. And that's a big quandary if you're managing $1 trillion or hundreds of billions of dollars. Very, very difficult one to manage. So watch this space on that one.
And bank sector finally, John.
Oh, the banks are going okay. I mean, we had a watch on that. I think last time we talked, we were watching the banks and saying, so far, so good. You know, 3 or 4 months further down the track. The September 6 months has just finished. That was the largest conversion of fixed rate lending to floating. The next 6 months to March, we're in. It's a lower level of conversion going on. But you'd have to say the banks are reporting that there are no problems in their loan books. And I would say if we get past March, there may be one more interest rate increase. I don't think that's going to rock the boat. People who have borrowed are paying back and servicing their debt as much as they can. Commonwealth Bank has reported that they're surprised at the level of offset accounts they have. You know, so borrowers have a lot of money in offset accounts. It has surprised me. I was certainly a little bit concerned about the outlook. I'm becoming less concerned. So I think the banks come out in the middle of next year with a reasonable bit of growth. And we've seen the banks' capital ratios are very strong. They will fall into the error, I think, again, of doing buybacks and trying to get their capital down to drive their profitability up. That's what banks do. I'd like to see higher dividends rather than buybacks, but that's another thing. But I think the outlook for banks is quite good. And we just look at the ones which are oversold, you know, probably ANZ and Westpac are being oversold. So there's probably some recovery there, if I'm right.
I describe them as some of the best income stocks in the world, which I don't think is a big claim at all. I think they are. And all they need to do to remain core holdings for most superannuants is not go into another banking crisis or a GFC. There are some seismic moments for the sector, but beyond that, don't expect too much growth. If there is some, fantastic, but the income is the obvious major attraction. Sorry, finally, I said banks lastly. Residential property market, John, thoughts?
Look, I think it really requires some credit controls in this country. Interest rates are a blunt instrument, and we're creating demand excesses through immigration. We're immigrating a lot of people, and we're also immigrating a reasonable number of people who've got capital to deploy, and the first thing they put capital into is residential property. So it's hard to see the residential property market pulling back given that demand. The only thing that would check the residential property market would be interest rates going up substantially. That's not going to happen. Interest rates not going up means that the chances of recession are very low, so we won't get unemployment. So that's not on the agenda. The only chance would be that APRA started and the Central Bank of Australia started telling the banks to not be so aggressive in lending. And that wouldn't mean cutting back on the amount of lending. It would be just putting some pressure on people who want to get a loan to have a bigger deposit. Now, we haven't done that for 30 years, and look at the mess we're in. So, but I would like to see some more credit control policy in this country for housing that would stabilise the housing market and let affordability catch up with prices rather than bringing prices down to affordability. But that takes a bit of forward thinking, which I don't see exhibited by government or central bank regulators.
And two final questions, actually, John. One is thoughts on the US election next year. Is that going to be a market event?
Well, I'm trying to not to think about it because it's still a year away. If I think about it and I see that the incumbent and the likely challenger and look at them and go, is that the best they've got? I don't want to think about it. I'm hoping that someone comes in both sides of politics over there from left field. But it's a long way to go. And when you're very orderly, like those two gentlemen are, one more than the other, anything can happen, as we know. So let's just leave it at that. I think the bigger issue for America is how they address their government debt. And I do have a statement in my letter that I think the way we're heading is that quantitative easing will probably have to come back in America to manage the debt of the American government and maintain interest rates at a reasonable level where the American government can service that debt. And that's going to be a problem whoever's the president. I think a Republican president would probably address that issue more so than the Democratic president. That's all I'd say on that. But if quantitative easing has to come back, that's another positive for the American asset markets, so to speak.
Right. And finally, John, I spoke to you on the couch in one of these podcasts in May earlier this year and asked you if you had to sell everything and buy one stock. You chose Microsoft, and you repeated that in our most recent podcast, since which time the stock's up 24%. Are you still Microsoft?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, you've got to be realistic. Revaluations like that lead to devaluations or market pullbacks. So I think I'd be buying Microsoft on a pullback. I also said Brickworks Group. If I had to sell everything and buy an Australian stock, I'd say the Brickworks Soul Patterson Group. I still think they've got excellent coverage of the Australian economy, and I think all the sectors they're in. We've got a question mark now over coal, given what is likely to happen in America in terms of stopping coal energy production by, I think, 2035. So there's issues there. But apart from that, building and industrial and investing, the Soul Patterson Group, Brickworks, I'd still stick with them as well.
Right. Well, as I leave you, John, we've had a good GDP number. The Commonwealth Bank is up 1.6%, NAB 1.7, Westpac 1.9, and ANZ 1.5. I think you've tipped the banks. We've caught the bottom, and I think they've heard John's a bull on banks. John, thank you very much. I will make the letter to investors from November that you've written available to members. Yep. And I look forward to our next On the Couch podcast.
Great. Thanks, Marcus. Thanks.